Good morning, all. Judge Williams is with us by speakerphone, so the full panel is here. It's just that you only are able to see two of us. But Judge Williams, you're on the phone?
I am. Good morning.
Good morning.
Judge Rosner.
Good morning, Judge Annie.
Our first case for argument this morning is Buddy Bell versus James Keating. Ms. Wang.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
My name is Elizabeth Wong. I represent Buddy Bell, the plaintiff in this case.
Could you keep your voice up just a little?
Yes.
Because that mainly records, it doesn't amplify.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Bell alleges that subsection D of the city's disorderly conduct ordinance violates the First Amendment and is also vague for voidness under the Due Process Clause. He brings both facial and as-applied challenges on those two grounds. The district court dismissed those claims on jurisdictional grounds, holding that Mr. Bell lacked standing to seek injunctive relief on his facial challenge.
Now, in his affidavit, Mr. Bell says that he intends to engage in peaceful protests again, but he doesn't contend that he intends to ignore a lawful order to disperse. So does that affect his standing?
No, Your Honor. It's true that Mr. Bell does not say in his affidavit, I intend to refuse to disperse where, under circumstances where there's three or more people in the immediate vicinity engaging in acts of disorderly conduct. He's not repeat the elements of the ordinance in his affidavit. However, he does state that because of his arrest on January 7, 2008, which we do not dispute was made with probable cause, he fears engaging in public protest in the future. And this is what distinguishes this case from Shermer. In Shermer, the problem was that there was no facts in that record showing that the plaintiffs in that case had been arrested at the Taste of Chicago in 2006 under circumstances where there are three more people engaging in disorderly conduct. And in that case, the allegations in that complaint said that they wanted to engage in protest in the future. And the court said if we had any facts in this record showing that the plaintiffs had been arrested or that there was at least arguable probable cause for their arrest, then they would have standing to seek relief on their facial challenge. And I think that's what distinguishes that case from this one. In this case, you know, admittedly, Mr. Bell could have been a little bit more specific in his affidavit, but I think that any fair reading of his affidavit shows that he intends to engage in the same conduct that he engaged in when he was arrested validly meaning where the elements of the ordinance were present, back on January 7th of 2008. And so he falls squarely under Babbitt in the sense that he wants to engage in conduct that is covered by the ordinance and that is affected with a constitutional interest, and there's a credible threat of prosecution. There's a credible threat of prosecution because the city has never disavowed using the ordinance. It has recently used the ordinance, and it has specifically said in this case and in other cases that have come before this court recently that it intends to enforce the ordinance in every instance where the elements of the ordinance are met, even if the people are engaged in First Amendment conduct.
So I take it that your bottom line argument is that because he alleges that he intends to engage in the same course of conduct, and because of the jury's finding that his conduct provided probable cause for arrest, that when you put those two elements together, you believe that you've demonstrated a credible threat of future prosecution?
Yes.
Now, the city seems to suggest that, again, speaking to the standing question, that it's speculative that three or more people will act in a disorderly fashion such that Bell would be commanded to disperse, and argue that we should extend the Lyons case. Can you speak to that point?
Yes, Your Honor. The Lyons case, the only part of Lyons that the city relies on is a sentence from that case where the court said that that plaintiff had not alleged, one, that he intended to have another encounter with the police where he would be in violation of a traffic or criminal law, and two, that the city of Los Angeles in that case had authorized or had a policy of enforcing illegal chokeholds in every instance where it had an encounter with a citizen. So the difference here is that the city has explicitly said that it intends to enforce the ordinance in every instance where the elements are met, even if the people are engaged in First Amendment conduct. This is not a case where – this is a case where we're not saying – it's not like Shermer in that it's not a misapplication of an ordinance where you can't even say that the elements of the ordinance were met. It's not a case like Lyons where there's a government official who is engaging in unconstitutional or illegal conduct that's unlikely to occur again in the future. Here, it is Mr. Bell intends to engage in the very conduct that the city has said is prohibited by the ordinance. And so, you know, that's the primary reason why we think that this case is distinguishable from Lyons. There's also the additional point that in Lyons, the plaintiff had not alleged a First Amendment claim, and so he was not suffering any present injury, and the court said that where you're not suffering any continuing adverse effects from a law, you can't have standing to challenge it. Here, we have the chilling of Mr. Bell's speech.
You don't challenge. Let's go on. You don't challenge the constitutionals. You do not challenge the constitutionality of Section A. Correct.
Correct.
Okay. If you don't challenge that underlying ordinance, the one that defines what activities constitute disorderly conduct, then don't we have to assume that Section A is a valid ordinance and focus solely on the elements of Section D?
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree with that. And I would say that the difference, so the city makes this argument that, well, you're not challenging subsection A and the triggering acts under subsection D are defined with reference to subsection A. And they make this argument that, the clause likely to cause serious inconvenience, annoyance, or alarm simply makes the ordinance better or narrower in some way. But that is simply not true because it takes what we might agree is an otherwise sort of objective standard where there would not be much likelihood of arbitrary and discriminatory enforcement and takes it and makes it a subjective standard. And as the Supreme Court said in Coates, conduct that is criminalizing conduct that's annoying does not give law enforcement officers the ability to know exactly what conduct is prohibited and not. And I'd like to just give a couple examples. For instance, if we had a law that said it's unlawful to play a drum in Federal Plaza, I think that we would agree that that is not vague. For vagueness purposes, that's not vague. You know what it is to play a drum. If you had a law that said it's unlawful to play a drum in an annoying or inconvenient or alarming manner in Federal Plaza, that would all of a sudden, I think that would make the law unconstitutionally vague. And, there could be other examples along that line. Playing music, what kind of music is annoying? Playing music itself might not be unconstitutionally vague, but if you add modifiers in some sense might narrow the scope of the ordinance in that, well, annoying conduct is prohibited, but not non-annoying conduct. So the world is smaller. But that does not mean that it makes it easier for the law enforcement officers to know what conduct is in that circle and what is outside of it.
Isn't that true, not in an unconstitutional sense, but in an arguably vague sense, that all disorderly conduct statutes, Ms. Wang, have within it an expansiveness or a flexibility that allows law enforcement to make some judgments?
It does.
Other than your example of the drum. I mean, I appreciate the absolute ban being clear, but aren't all statutes, and I'm sure you've looked at many of the disorderly conduct statutes, not just this one, carry with it some elasticity, let's say, that still would be within constitutional bounds?
Yes, and we don't disagree that in general breach of the peace, common law breach of the peace has had many definitions, and there's many state statutes and municipal ordinances that include disorderly conduct or breach of the peace in some sense. But in this case, and I was not able to find any ordinances or statutes that are just like this one, that include this language, serious inconvenience, annoyance, or alarm. Now, I will say that there are statutes out there where it says it is unlawful to intend to commit a disorderly act with intention to cause annoyance or alarm. But I think that the intent requirement makes a difference than this statute, which actually doesn't even require that the person who's ordered to disperse do anything other than be in the immediate vicinity. And the city hasn't provided any examples of other laws that are similar to this one. So while in general I would agree that breach of the peace statutes are supposed to be context specific, and this court and Supreme Court has given lots of examples where, for instance, somebody yelling, being loud and disruptive at a protest is not a breach of the peace, but if you're doing that in a courtroom, that would be. So yes, there needs to be some elasticity, but I think that the problem with this ordinance is that clause that says likely to cause serious inconvenience or annoyance or alarm. And that is, as far as I can tell, pretty unique amongst breach of the peace.
Could I take you back to standing for just a moment? Suppose we had a hypothetical Bobby Bell next to Buddy Bell and did not go through Mr. Bell's experience in the state court. But he was on the scene and then dispersed in. Would he have standing, having witnessed the experience of Buddy Bell?
Yes, he would. And the citation for that is Stuffel versus Thompson. In Stuffel versus Thompson, the person who was the plaintiff in that case was not actually ever arrested under the trespass statute. He and his companion were handbilling, and his companion was arrested. The plaintiff had been threatened with arrest, and he saw his companion taken away and arrested. And yet the court in that case said that the plaintiff, who had not ever been arrested, did have standing.
But he was threatened with arrest, you say?
He was threatened.
Yeah, I'm thinking of an immediate vicinity. That's my hypothetical being a Bobby Bell, but whatever. Who witnesses it? I just want to see the range of both in venue and in number what you would do with standing in this case.
I would say if the person was a part of the protest. So it couldn't just be any bystander who, had no intention of engaging.
Well, 300 people in our plaza on that day who had sight of the corner.
So any person in the crowd?
Yeah, I want to make it reasonable, but we all know this venue because it's so adjacent to where we are today. I'm just trying to see if what the parameters are. Can we cabin your standing argument in just not a specific number, but I'm thinking of the kinds of groups that we have in our plaza regularly protesting like this, and where we would go on standing if they witnessed the incident with Mr. Bell.
Well, I think it still comes back to whether they, in a pre-enforcement, a person certainly wouldn't have to be arrested in order to have standing. You can have a pre-enforcement challenge. And so I think that if he had an intention to engage in conduct that's prohibited by
what
the ordinance.
If I look from my chambers, which overlooks the plaza, I'm not privileged to have the lake view that Judge Rovner has. But I have an urban view, I think, it's in real estate. But I see the plaza, and I witness this occurrence with Mr. Bell.
No,
I'm sympathetic to that protest and its aims.
I don't think you would have standing unless you intended to engage in conduct in the future.
Well, let's say I'm not, as I say, not unsympathetic to that particular protest, and maybe if it's not a day I'm sitting, I would be willing to.
Come and look at Judge Rovner's view.
I don't think you would have standing. I don't think it's enough to say, well, maybe one day I will join them.
Well, I'm obviously not trying to take this to an extreme. I'm just trying to, as I say, cabin it for purposes of standing. But
now
you can see the difficulty, at least I seem to have, with where we, how far we go with it.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
And I'm having a little trouble. I do want to ask you about this, seeing how intermediate scrutiny should apply to the ordinance when it is not overtly directed at speech on its face. In other words, the person ordered to disperse can be there to speak or to dance or to sell hot dogs, you know, heaven only knows. If the ordinance doesn't care what the person ordered to disperse is doing, why should we treat this like an ordinance that's directed toward regulating speech?
Because it regulates, in ARCARA, the court said that, I mean, ARCARA is distinguishable for the reasons that we say in our brief, but it also said that breach of the peace statutes are normally analyzed under O'Brien. And I think that in this case, the conduct that's sought to be regulated is intimately related to the protected activity. That is, any speech or protest that is controversial in nature is likely to have a situation where there's three or more people in the immediate vicinity that are, you know, doing something that's disturbing the public peace and quiet. And I think for the same reasons that this court said in that the curfew law in Hodgkins should be analyzed under intermediate scrutiny, I think the same applies here. In Hodgkins, there was nothing about the curfew law that said anything about expressive conduct or speech. It was simply a curfew law that made it illegal to be outside at night. And I think the same applies here.
All right. We asked you a fair number of questions, Ms. Wang, so I'll allow you some rebuttal time.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Norberg?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Subsection.
You can move that up.
Yeah, you know, I'm going to turn it.
I mean, you can move it.
Move
the whole thing up.
I don't know how to do
that. Well, we'll give
that.
You some assistance there.
Never done that.
If you want, you can obscure yourself from us.
Oh. Now, we wouldn't want that, Judge Rovner, would we?
I don't know. Let's see.
May it please the Court. Subsection D allows an officer to issue a dispersal order if and only if three or more persons in the immediate vicinity are engaged in serious disorderly conduct.
Forgive me, but I think we need to address standing before we address the merits.
Sure, absolutely.
Under the circumstances. And for me, I think this case is clearly distinguishable from Shermer. A jury found in this instance that the officers had probable cause to arrest Bell. So this was not an isolated misapplication of the law. Bell's conduct, I think, is clearly covered by the statute. And Bell tells us, you know, he is likely to engage in this conduct again, holding up anti-war signs on a street corner with friends during a presidential visit. And if you think that conduct, you know, is unlikely to be repeated, then you were hiding in a bunker somewhere during the NATO summit. So why is that not enough for standing?
Well, I think I had a couple answers to that, Judge Rovner, if I may. First of all, and I don't mean to get overly technical on the record problem they have, but we felt we needed to bring that up, and that is that the affidavit does not really say what they say it says. And first problem is that it doesn't really even say he's planning on engaging in future protests. There are judicial representations in the briefs and some of the papers to that effect. But another problem that, Judge Rovner, you pointed out was that he also does not say that were he to be put in a situation where he was ordered to disperse, that he would refuse to disperse. So from a record perspective, from a factual, from what he has within his control that he can say he's intending to do, there's a problem. But the larger problem here is the fact that past enforcement, legitimate past enforcement like this, is only part of the puzzle, and it's actually ultimately a relatively small part of the puzzle. It gives you sort of a foothold to say it makes my expectation of future application more realistic. But you still need to establish that there's a realistic probability that it's going to be applied to you in the future. And the problem here for them, first of all, is a Lyons problem. Now, Judge Williams, you mentioned that it would be an extension of Lyons. We actually believe this is an application of Lyons, the concept that the court is generally, as a matter of policy essentially, unwilling to assume future unlawful conduct on the part of the plaintiff, much less on the part of other parties. So in this situation, and I would beg to differ slightly from Ms. Wong with her characterization of Lyons, in Lyons, the court made clear that even were Mr. Lyons to say, I am going to do everything within my power to contact the police and put myself in a position where I might be put in this chokehold again, that still would not be enough to support standing because the court was not willing to make that assumption that illegal conduct would happen in the future.
Under your view of standing, could an individual plaintiff ever have standing to challenge Section D on its face?
It's very difficult to come up with a scenario in which that might happen, and I have tried. Now, that is not to say that perhaps someone in the future, another plaintiff, might be able to put forth a theory of standing that would get around this Lyons problem.
How did the plaintiff in Coates have standing, if your theory is correct? Because that ordinance also was triggered only when three or more people were engaged in conduct annoying two persons passing by. So, I mean, in other words, was the Supreme Court wrong to assume that an individual could challenge this law, even though that meant assuming that three people would simultaneously break the law in the future?
Well, I mean, I guess I'd have two points to that. First, Coates did predate Lyons, and I think Lyons was sort of an interesting interpretation of standing, and it is a bellwether case, so perhaps Coates would have been decided differently post-Lyons. Secondly, and this goes to a more fundamental problem with Mr. Bell's standing argument that actually allied with the merits to some extent, and that is that Mr. Coates obviously had a protected constitutional right to act in an annoying manner, to do any number of things that might be annoying but would still be constitutionally protected. So it made perfect sense for him to argue and for the court to assume, although they don't really discuss it in detail in that case, that he was being chilled from specific conduct in the future. Here, what Mr. Bell's fundamental problem is that the conduct that he is essentially inevitably asserting a right to undertake is not even arguably protected by the First Amendment. He asserts, inevitably, the only way you can interpret his theory is that the First Amendment and the Constitution protects his right to protest in the immediate vicinity of a serious disorderly event. And the First Amendment just simply does not go that far.
How does this...
Under your theory of standing, just so I'm sure I'm clear on your theory, no plaintiff could ever have standing to challenge a statute because the statute is only triggered when third parties commit disorderly conduct. And what I'm having trouble with is how you square that with what we said in Shermer, that a plaintiff could have standing if the police were arguably acting within the ordinance.
Well, I think that in Shermer, the way I interpret Shermer, the way we interpret Shermer, is that, as I said at the beginning of my remarks, past legitimate, I'll call it, enforcement of a law against somebody is evidence, as the Supreme Court said in O'Shea, of the plausibility and the realistic expectation of future application. So in Shermer, I think what the court said is that if you can establish past, then you could then establish standing. It does not foreclose the fact that you need to also show that there is a sufficient likelihood that the challenged law will be enforced against you in the future.
But Shermer was wrongfully arrested for conduct that didn't come within the provisions of the ordinance. He was arrested without probable cause. And that gave him standing to seek money damages for the wrongful arrest, but it didn't give him standing to bring a facial challenge to the ordinance seeking injunctive relief.
I, The interpretation of Shermer that we've arrived at is that essentially what the court says in Shermer is that Shermer and Goldhamer cannot even show past enforcement. Therefore, ipso facto, we are not going to assume the realistic possibility of future enforcement.
No. You know, they weren't able to make the showing because their arrest was baseless.
Right.
So they had no real fear that the ordinance would be applied to them again in the future because this was an isolated incident of misuse of the ordinance.
Absolutely.
Okay,
no, I don't mean at all to dispute the fact that this case is distinguishable from Shermer, and we do not rely on Shermer as a basis for finding no standing here. In fact, the argument, the concept of the possibility and the probability,
the district court never even considered the merits because he believed that the plaintiff didn't have standing under the court's decision in Shermer.
That's absolutely right.
And that's the record that you're up here in front of us with.
That is true. That is the judgment that is before this court, and we are asking for affirmance of the judgment on the standing grounds, but we are asking for affirmance not necessarily based on the specific reasoning that the district court applied in this case, because to be honest with you, we're not entirely convinced, as the district court seems to have been, that, in fact, we're not convinced at all, that Shermer is indistinguishable and controls in this case. Our point is that you need to take a step further, and actually the salient question for standing purposes is the probability of future enforcement. And that's where we get into the Lyons question, where in order to find a sufficient probability, the court needs to assume that there is going to be illegal conduct. Now, of course, I absolutely concede and understand that, generally speaking, the standard for standing is relatively low. It's a non-trivial possibility or probability of future enforcement. So from a common sense perspective, one could say it is, and I think that opposing counsel made the point that these type of situations often turn into situations where it will be triggered. But that does not change the fact that in Lyons, that if this court is to find standing here, that it would need to figure out a way to finesse Lyons and say we are willing to make the assumption of unlawful conduct in the future and get to the merits.
How does this ordinance apply to reporters? I mean, I would assume that reporters, you know, whether they're professional or amateurs, need by the nature of the work to be in the presence of public demonstrations on which they're reporting. And why wouldn't that demonstrate the facial infirmity of the ordinance?
Well, imagine, for example, a situation where there was a large riot going on in front of City Hall on LaSalle Street. And not a riot. It's not a riot yet. It's a protest. It's a gathering of people. It's a newsworthy event. And there are reporters and protesters and people there. And then all of a sudden, three or more people take it upon themselves to set a car on fire with a Molotov cocktail and rock it and tip it over. Now, under Mr. Bell's theory and under... If I'm understanding the possible import of your question, Judge Rovner, a protester who was protesting in the immediate vicinity of that car 10 feet away, or a reporter who was reporting on it 10 feet away, would have some sort of absolute right under the First Amendment to disregard and disobey the police saying, we need everyone to clear out so that we can take care of this situation. Obviously, that the First Amendment does not go so far. The First Amendment must give way at some point to the right of the city and of the police in this situation to ensure the public safety and convenience and the public welfare. So, I mean, that very hypothetical that I'm positing here puts the lie to the idea that there are no constitutional applications of this ordinance.
Now, here comes the question that you've been waiting for. Let's talk about Thayer. And footnote 3 of the red brief, where you argue that you may still contest standing here because the party may always contest subject matter jurisdiction. Have you taken inconsistent views in these two cases, Thayer and Bell?
Yes. I think our position on, and if I may, in a sense, throw myself on the mercy of the court.
No, not this group.
What happened in this case is that we had not focused on the standing issue until Goldhamer came out. And that, I think, to both sides was sort of a surprising result because neither side had argued that there was a lack of standing. Thayer had already been briefed at that point, and then the Bell decision came down based on standing completely. So obviously in the Bell briefing, we needed to address the standing issue. So what we did is we thought harder, perhaps. I can see we should have thought harder about the standing issue from the very beginning of these three cases. But we developed and came to the position that Lyons is relevant and that the affidavit testimony here was relevant. And so what we did is we briefed it the way we briefed it with that footnote. And then in the Thayer case, we sought and were given leave to file a supplemental jurisdictional memorandum making the standing points that we make here in Bell. So Thayer, as the first submitted case, I assume would in a sense have the right to take the first pass at that question. I'm informing the court of that, and in case the court was not aware of that. But in both cases, the legal question of whether or not, essentially, not the legal question, but the question what it takes to establish standing to challenge this ordinance has been presented and briefed. Regrettably, we didn't do it in the exact right order, but now we believe all of our ducks are finally in a row, and we've presented it squarely.
Can I ask you a question related to vagueness? There seem to be multiple layers of vagueness with the ordinance as it is. First, an officer needs to determine if there's been a disorderly disturbance. Then the officer needs to determine if it's annoying or alarming. Then the bystanders need to figure out if the police officer's determination was lawful. How can officers apply the law in a consistent, non-arbitrary manner?
Well, I think that Judge Williams, as Judge Flaum recognized, that disorderly conduct is an area of the law where there is necessarily some flexibility and some play in the joints. And that at the end of the day, if there is an application of the ordinance that is, for example, as the court found in Shermer, specious or incorrect, that as applied challenge to the enforcement is the proper way to challenge that. In terms of what, it's a bit perplexing what Mr. Bell's argument is on this point, because he seems to argue that subsection A is fine, and the problem becomes when you start considering whether things are annoying, seriously annoying, seriously inconvenient, etc. But I think as we explained in our brief, what that does is it says it's not always going to be enough that there's just technically subsection A violations going on. We are going to allow the police to let crowds remain in the vicinity of some of those if and when it is plausible from an operational perspective to do that. The only time we're going order dispersal is when they determine in their experience and on the ground and in an as applied case by case basis that the type of disorderly conduct, for example, the burning car hypothetical I posited, is such that they really need to clear the area to take care of the situation. Now, it doesn't have to be a burning car necessarily. It could be something well short of that, but ultimately it is a limiting. It is a limiting factor in the ordinance, and it shouldn't be seen as a basis for saying that somehow the ordinance overreaches when it actually allows the officers to rein in what they could possibly do, and that is, what we could have done, or what Mr. Bell seems to be suggesting we could have done, and that is leave that clause out of the ordinance and just had it be that whenever there are three or more people violating subsection A, you can order dispersal. That would have been a much broader ordinance, and it wouldn't have allowed for as much flexibility as is needed in the disorderly conduct context.
Now, would you, Mr. Norberg, say, though, that to take your position, one would have to read in some limitation on venue? So take your example of the car and the disruption on LaSalle Street. And there's a significant group of people, as you said, protesting, let's say, within the range of the block or a block and a half, whatever we would agree on as a hypothetical. And it couldn't be reasonable, could it, if for the dispersal order to be in effect to remove you to Roosevelt Road and Chicago Avenue? In other words, kind of redirect all conduct away from the scene. Certainly, you've got to have emergency vehicles and the like to attend to the hypothetical you suggest. So would you say that one would have to read that kind of venue limitation in? So in other words, the police couldn't take advantage and end all demonstration because they needed to attend to the immediate vicinity.
Yes, I think that that's something I agree with you. I think that conceivably in a particular situation, in ordering dispersal, the police could conceivably, without conceding it would be unconstitutional in every particular instance, could overreach and tell people to disperse by telling them everyone needs to go home, get off all the streets of the city of Chicago, we're putting in a curfew or something, we're locking everything down. That would obviously be problematic. But, I mean, that did not happen in this case.
No,
I appreciate that, but I'm
trying to, you know, as I say, speaking with, having a dialogue with Ms. Wang, trying to, what are the parameters here that could sustain a position such as that you're advancing, that's all.
Sure, and I think the last point I would make, since I see that I'm obviously out of time, is that in Hedgewood recently and also in Flipside, the Supreme Court, Hedgewood in this court and Flipside in the Supreme Court, it made clear that it has to be impermissibly vague in every application. So the problem you're bringing up here, once again, there could be situations where it is unconstitutionally applied, but that does not mean that there are not conceivably constitutional applications of the dispersal proximity aspect of the ordinance.
All right.
So at any rate, I would ask the court to affirm the judgment of the district court on the standings ground. And if it does not do that, I would ask that you affirm on the merits. Thank you.
Thank you, Snowy. Ms. Wang, you may have an additional couple of minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. To pick up on a point that Mr. Norberg was making, with respect to the point about giving the police discretion to decide when to disperse people where it's truly needed, the point is that the clause, serious inconvenience, annoyance, or alarm, gives the police discretion to decide when something is inconvenient, alarming, or annoying. And as the Supreme Court has said, those terms are inherently subjective, for which there can be no, there's no way that those terms can be defined in a way that avoids arbitrary or discriminatory enforcement or gives fair notice to people.
Well, but Ms. Wang, back to our earlier exchange, how do you define breach of the peace in a way other than allowing for, you know, a fair amount of subjective interpretation? That's kind of the struggle I have with dealing with this area.
Well, I don't think breach of the peace has to include those terms. And one.
So you're saying specificity invites broader discretion. The city's position, as I read it, is specificity narrows it. So you're saying that if, well, you heard Mr. Norberg suggest dropping that, what that language, if it's objectionable to you, is dropped. You think that would narrow police discretion?
It would make the ordinance more precise. I mean, I think.
Well, I no question in a language sense. We've got to think of the officer and when she's on the street and making a judgment call.
Yes, I think that would make the ordinance would no longer be unconstitutionally vague, because a police officer cannot. It's an inherently subjective judgment whether conduct is annoying or not, or inconvenient or not. And, you know, this court in Schroger versus Weiglin recently talked about its prior decisions on breach of the peace and what breach of the peace means, and it gave a definition that's in the Restatement of Torts, which is, you know, the best kind of definition of breach of the peace that we could have would say that it is conduct that is likely to incite violence or creates violence or, you know, an immediate disturbance of the public order. And I think that definition is closer to what this ordinance would be if you took out the subjective
terms. You really think
terms.
That language you just quoted in the hands of of an individual, a Chicago police officer, would give him a focus or her a focus apart from the kind that we're investing with them now in the current ordinance?
Well, I mean, certainly anything that says it's conduct that is likely to incite violence or create violence or something like that would I think those are sort of objective terms. And I think that that would make the ordinance constitutional.
All right. I don't want to cut you off if you had one final comment.
No, Your Honor.
All right. Well, thank you, Swank. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.